Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 20th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we discuss the House of Representatives versus Burwell, the latest Obamacare challenge. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to welcome return guest. I keep saying return guest more and more often, but return teleforum guest, Professor Josh Blackman. He's Assistant Professor of Law at the South Texas College of Law. He's going to give us some background on the case and talk about the case for about 10 to 15 minutes or so, and then we'll turn to the audience for questions. With that, welcome, Professor Blackman. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you so much for having me back. So today we're discussing House of Representatives v. Burwell, and this case has a very fascinating history. It actually arose during 2014 when the House of Representatives decided to file suit against the executive branch for its implementation of the Affordable Care Act. You may recall that initially the thrust of the complaint was to challenge the president's delay of the employer mandate. After a fairly lengthy back and forth, the government added a second claim that the Obama administration was basically spending money that was never appropriated. So this lawsuit was filed in November of 2014 by the House of Representatives. There have been two decisions since then that are of great worth, and I will discuss both of them today. First, in about 6 months ago, the court ruled in favor of standing for the House. Second, the decision that was last week, the court ruled that, in fact, that President Obama's administration was spending money that wasn't appropriated. These are significant decisions that will quickly be appealed up and may wind their way to the Supreme Court in the next year or two. So let's focus first on what the actual claim is. And I apologize, I need to give you numbers. So there are two sections of the ACA that are important, Section 1401 and Section 1402. Section 1401 provides the tax subsidies when a person buys a insurance policy on the Obamacare exchanges. You may recall last year in King v. Burwell that the court held that these subsidies can be paid out even if a state fails to establish an exchange. When Congress wrote Section 1401, they created what's called a permanent appropriation. That is, no matter what happens, whether the government's alive or dead, there will still be money left over for these subsidies. They will always be there. This is why even if you shut down the government, most government spending actually continues because it's a permanent appropriation. That's the dirty little secret. There are no government shutdowns. It goes on forever. The other key section we're talking about today is Section 1402. 1402 doesn't give money to people for their policies. Instead, it pays money to the insurance companies for so-called cost sharing. So, for example, insurance companies charge you deductibles, copays, and these sorts of fees. The ACA restricts how much money the insurance companies can charge for these items. There's a key difference, though. Whereas Congress created a permanent appropriation for 1401, they didn't create any appropriation for 1402. Now, this might seem like not a big deal. If Congress passes a statute and doesn't include a permanent appropriation, what that means is every year when the administration submits its budget to Congress, they include a request for this money. And indeed, that's how the Obama administration treated it. In its fiscal year 2014 budget, the Office of Management and Budget requested $1.4 billion to fund Section 1402. Again, no one flinched. They said, okay, we need about $1 billion for this program. Congress, give it to us. Unsurprisingly, Congress at that point, the House was controlled by Republicans, and they said, no, we will not fund this provision of Obamacare, which is basically giving more money to insurance companies. Let them suffer. Good policy decision, bad policy decision, I don't care. It doesn't really matter. But Congress said no. What happened next, though, is kind of crazy. As I will discuss in my forthcoming book, Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power, they discovered something. So some of the lawyers in the House and some of the lawyers advising them were researching budgets and said, wait a minute. In last year's budget, the president requested $1.5 billion for this, And in this year, he didn't request that money. The government never requests less money. So what gives, they asked. Well, it turned out the Obama administration decided, well, since there was a Congress denied our request for an appropriation, we'll simply find the money elsewhere. Indeed, they argued that all along Congress had actually appropriated that money through the permanent appropriation. But wait a minute. Didn't I just say a minute ago the appropriation was only for 1401? This is the basis of the case. The government is basically arguing that the money appropriated for 1401 also includes 1402 spending. Okay? This is what the House of Representatives challenged in federal court. So the first part of the decision by Judge Collier from last fall discussed whether, in fact, the House can sue over this. Now, we've had a lot of cases where individual members of Congress have tried to sue in federal court, and they lose. The most famous case was one from 1996 or 7 called Raines v. Byrd. Senator Robert Byrd, among others, filed suit to challenge the constitutionality of the Line Item Veto Act. And the Supreme Court held, no, you cannot do this. As individual members of Congress, you have no interest in how the president enforces the laws and whether these laws are constitutional. But there was this one dictum in Justice Stevens' majority opinion where he said, it's relevant that these members of Congress are not authorized by their body to sue. Huh. There are a couple other cases involving standing to suit by state governments. There was a case from the 1930s involving the state of, I think it was Kansas, and there was actually another case from about a year ago involving the state of Arizona. And the courts have suggested that state governments, when the entire legislature is authorized to sue, may have standing. These cases are somewhat muddled. I don't want to waste your time with them, but it doesn't provide a clear answer one way or the other. So here we have a case where it's not, you know, John Boehner or Paul Ryan bringing the suit. The House of Representatives voted to authorize a suit. Indeed, this was the same procedure through which the Windsor case, the Defense of Marriage Act case, was litigated. The House authorized the BLAG, the Bipartisan Legal Advisor Group, to actually defend DOMA when the president would not. So, I mean, we have this procedure. So what happened here? The House authorized the suit, and it was brought by Jonathan Turley of George Washington University, and they asserted that this money is being spent illegally. So Judge Collier first recognized that the precedents don't cut either way. There's no precedent saying the House as a whole can bring the suit, and there's no precedent saying the House cannot bring the suit. I mean, it's to pardon a phrase, unprecedented. She said in this limited situation, she thought that standing was appropriate, right? Why? This is not a traditional grievance where the president and Congress simply disagree. This is a structural complaint where the president is spending power without an appropriation. This cuts the purse strings on the power of the purse, which James Madison said was the most effective way of checking the executive branch. Once the president can spend money when Congress doesn't appropriate it, Congress really does not have much left to govern because that's the primary role of the legislative branch. So she tried to limit or cabin her standing theory to this non-appropriation theory of standing. Again, I freely admit this is somewhat unprecedented. No court has held this before, but she held this. And the next move, which was even more interesting, was that the government filed what's called they sought an interlocutory appeal. What does that mean? They wanted to appeal right away on standing. They did not want to go on to the merits. In a move that surprised me and many others, the court denied the interlocutory appeal. Judge Collier said, don't waste your time. Let's resolve this on the merits. That way you can appeal the full case to the D.C. Circuit, and we don't waste time. The government was probably not happy about that. They perhaps could have sought mandamus, although I don't think they were going to do that. Okay, that brings us to the case we have before us now from last week. Once the government gets past standing, they're in trouble. They are in trouble because their arguments are not very good. Their first argument, which is somewhat convoluted, is that, in fact, the text of the statute does provide a permanent appropriation for 1402. Judge Collier wrote, this is a most curious and convoluted argument whose mother was undoubtedly necessity. In other words, the lawyers at the Justice Department had to make something up. They have to give some textualist argument. Thank you, Justice Scalia. The government's second position was that, well, you know what? 1401 and 1402 are integrated, right? They're much the same. And we have to read them together. So the appropriation from 1401 applies to 1402. Judge Collier rejected that, saying that you can't infer appropriations. She said you can't squeeze 1402 into the mouth hole of 1401. That's this huge elephant theory we see a lot in admin law. The third one was somewhat similar to the King v. Burwell argument last year, that if the court reads the ACA this way, it will yield these absurd financial health care results and basically destroy Obamacare. Judge Collier's response, I think, was actually quite sound. She said, look, the problem is not the ACA. The problem is that the Congress denied the president's funding request. There's nothing within the statute Congress wrote that compels this result. In fact, it let Congress in the future decide, do we want to continue funding this, or maybe Obamacare is not working well? Let's defund parts of it, which is what the court did. So the court quickly rejected these three arguments, and this was frankly a serious loss from the government. Okay, so in my remaining few minutes before we go to questions, I want to discuss what happens next. So no doubt the court will appeal this to the D.C. Circuit. This will go up very soon. And if the D.C. Circuit rules that there's no standing, the government will never again have a chance to actually have to argue the merits. But to the extent that the panel requests briefing on it, again, the court will have to address the merits of whether the government can actually do this. We're still about 2 years away from the Supreme Court, and Judge Collier stayed her decision, so there's nothing the government has to change now. But I can tell you that insurance companies are worried, right? They make their forecasts and estimates for their insurance premiums based on these subsidies. If it turns out that these subsidies have to be appropriated every year, that creates risk, and insurance companies don't like risk, so that this does threaten to inject even more instability into Obamacare. This will not destroy Obamacare, but it will make things a little bit more difficult for the insurance companies. Ultimately, the decision rests with Congress. If Congress writes a one-sentence permanent appropriation, this case goes away. But the fact is Congress has not done that, which is the reason why we're here. I will stop here and turn it back over to Dean, and we can move on to whatever questions that you all may have. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thank you, Professor. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me ask the first question. And that's, you mentioned the merits. You mentioned we're going to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals soon, likely, on the question of standing. Does the government have a case on the merits? Do they have a defense on the merits here?
You know, I'll answer your question like this. Nicholas Bagley, who's been one of the most articulate defenders of the ACA from the University of Michigan, has basically written, you know, the government has no leg to stand on here on the merits. All they have is standing. All they have is political question doctrine. This is one of those cases where you really wonder what the government was thinking. If I can make a slight diversion, about a month ago, the state of West Virginia argued their appeal for the D.C. Circuit. West Virginia, led by General Morrissey and Albert Lynn, their SG, challenged the delay of the individual mandate, the so-called administrative fix. And at one point during the oral arguments, Judge Lawrence Silberman asked the DOJ lawyer, and I'll read this quote, when the government took the action it took, did it think that no one would have standing to challenge it? In other words, when you did this, right, you have no actual defense of the merits. Did you just think that no one would have standing to challenge it? And that's a striking thought, right? If indeed the president is breaking the law, and its only meaningful defense is no one can stop me, that's scary. That's the stuff that really worries me. And to have lawyers get up there and simply, you know, shake their heads no, and you know they're not going to answer these questions because there's no standing. I think, and respectfully, this is something that conservatives should rethink about standing doctrine, right? If standing doctrine was created, you know, Justice Scalia said this is part of the separation of powers, right, to keep courts out of the business of adjudicating these disputes. But if the president is insulating himself from serious constitutional violations by simply saying no injury, no standing, this warrants a second thinking of standing doctrine. And I think this case and the West Virginia case really articulate this quite well.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button. Let's go to our first caller.
Professor Blackman, thank you for this. My name is Stephen Casey, attorney in Austin, Texas. I do some legal work at times for a company that combines healthcare sharing with the MEC, funded Affordable Care Act, the minimum essential coverage. The question I would have is, from a long-term perspective, are these consumers then going, these insurance companies, they're not going to be reimbursed, so eventually I would think that they would just stop paying on these, but now they've got a contractual obligation to pay. So now you're talking about standing, the constitutional challenge and the political question, but the question I would have is, do these insurance companies then have a suit against the government based on that promise to pay, or is there going to be shift the lawsuits over to these low-income folks who are then going to sue the insurance companies for failure to pay under these plans that have already been allegedly approved and allegedly funded, but now we're finding out based on what you said that they're not?
Thank you for the question. The short answer is there is indeed an obligation to pay, and if the government does not have the appropriation, the insurance companies go to the Court of Federal Claims, Washington, D.C., it's right across the street from the White House, and file a suit requesting payments. That comes out of the judgment fund, which is a permanent appropriation. So there's nothing stopping the insurance companies from getting it, but the process will not be seamless. They'll have to go and litigate. I mean, the government may not contest it, or who knows, the Trump administration may contest it. Who the hell knows, right? But they can get their money. So in the meantime, the insurance companies are out of luck. But this case has stayed, right? There's nothing changing now. So we're at least 2 years away from a SCOTUS decision on this, if ever. So the insurance companies maybe are worried about this in the long term, but in the short term, there's nothing emergency. I think the bigger question is, how is the government going to defend what is pretty clearly spending money illegally? And it's a really stunning thought. Thank you.
Yeah, I could follow up on that real quick. As far as, separation of powers, it also shows, I think, just an incredible foresight of pushing through the checks and balances to the highest level. Because, we've got, the Supreme Court, a lot of people say that it was a tax and it wasn't a tax, and they disagree with the Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Care Act. But then it comes back around to there's another check in the system of now this appropriation issue. And I just don't see us getting past this, and it may be like you're talking about, and I haven't had the opportunity to read your book, but that it's just going to crumble apart based on a getting further cooked, if you will, on the grill of checks and balances.
Crumble apart, or maybe it will unravel. Thank you very much for the question.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Let me take you back, if I could, Professor, to this what you've mentioned on standing, that the government really has no case on the merits. If I'm understanding you correctly, and this is a little astounding, so we might be covering ground you've already covered, but what I hear you saying is the government from this point forward, or even in the past, might be free to set a policy goal, identify a policy goal, and then never engage in a serious assessment of whether its proposed activity is legal or not, but merely try to make their activity standing proof and unchallengeable in court. Now, have I got that correct? And are you saying that the D.C. Circuit in the West Virginia case suspects that, or is hinting at that, or?
Well, in the West Virginia case, you had a panel. It was Judge Kavanaugh, Judge Silberman, and one other. I'm drawing a blank on the third member, and they both seemed very suspicious on the merits. But I think under our standing doctrine, West Virginia probably doesn't have the strongest case. But they were both suspicious, saying, but if we peel back the curtains, this is very scary. I'll give you another example if I can. Under the Affordable Care Act, when it was being drafted, Senator Grassley put an amendment in saying, listen, if we're going to have Obamacare, the members of Congress and their staff have to go to the Obamacare exchanges. We want the people on the Capitol Hill to have the same treatment as the people in the rest of America. But there's a problem there. Currently, members of Congress and their staff get really generous health insurance benefits. They have to get, I think it's like a 75% subsidy of the price of the policy. If you go on the Obamacare exchange, you're not going to get those generous policies. In fact, if you have a high household income, you're going to get zero subsidies. So this law would have basically forced a lot of people in Congress to go onto Obamacare. Well, that can't be the case, right? That's absolutely awful. So what happened? The president and his Office of Personnel Management issued a fix. They said, okay, we will treat get ready for this. This one's a laugher. We will treat Congress as a series of small businesses. And because you're a small business, you can buy insurance on the DC Small Business Obamacare Exchange. It's laughable. Congress is not a small business. This is an absolutely absurd interpretation of the statute. And oh, by the way, once you're a small business, we'll give you the same 75% subsidy. So there's basically no difference in how much benefits the members of Congress are getting. This is insane. So Senator Ron Johnson and one of his aides sued, actually represented by Paul Clement at the time. The district court dumped the case saying, look, there's no standing here, right? Members of Congress can't sue because they don't like it. In fact, Senator Johnson was actually better off because of this, because he got more benefits. But the judge, Judge Griesbach in Wisconsin, wrote, there's something fishy going on. He said, quote, taking the allegations as true, the executive branch has rewritten a key provision of the ACA so it's rendered essentially meaningless, right? So effectively, because these are benevolent suspensions that no one's injured, the president has carte blanche to simply rewrite the laws. This is scary, and this is something that should worry everyone, regardless of you know, politics, whatever else. Once the president can rewrite the laws, and the courts have to look away at this abuse because there's no standing, the separation of powers start to look very shaky.
So it this is Dean Reuter. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. We'll wait for further questions. Our lines are open. It almost – I don't know, Josh, if you could tell us if something has changed recently in standing, or has it more or less always been the case that the president's free to hand out a gratuity, essentially, because it harms no one. Therefore, nobody has standing to challenge it. And we're left to the political process.
Right. So – what's interesting here is that historically, when the president engages in dubious action, he's doing too much, right? He's enforcing the law too much. What I think President Obama has seized on the last 7 or 8 years is saying, well, maybe I'll do less, right? Maybe I won't enforce this mandate that hurts people. Maybe I won't enforce this mandate that hurts those people. Maybe I won't enforce this mandate that deprives healthcare to members of Congress that's cheap. And these benevolent suspensions don't inflict injuries. And I think this was the heart of Judge Silberman's question, right? I mean, I'm not saying this was his opinion, but he asked this question during arguments. Did you guys from the government think that no one has standing to challenge it? Is this why you did it? And the government lawyer said, no, not to my knowledge, Your Honor, which I think was the fair answer for the lawyer to give. But this has been the way that they've implemented Obamacare, and the way they have, the way they've implemented just about everything else. Even look at the immigration case, right? Their main defense is that the state of Texas lacks standing. But once you go into the merits, their case starts looking a lot shakier. You know, this is something that I think people on the federal side and elsewhere should reconsider standing doctrine. I have a piece in National Review, which I'm sure you guys can tweet to later, but making this point that historically standing doctrine is viewed by conservatives as a way of keeping, you know, activist courts with their hand out of the cookie jar. So, you know, David Bazelon and his colleagues can't, you know, tell the government what to do. But I think now it's gone the exact opposite direction, where courts have simply are forced to pull wool over their eyes at clear constitutional violations.
We've got a couple questions pending now, so let's turn back to the audience. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Oh, hi, this is Warren Belmar with a question. With respect to the issues you were just addressing, has there been any role played by the Comptroller General of the United States, who has responsibility for enforcing the Anti-Deficiency Act, which makes individuals liable for misfinancial management?
It's a very good question. To be frank, I don't know the answer, but if indeed the court ultimately rules that these payments were illegal, there are going to be serious Anti-Deficiency Act actions. There have to be. I mean, we're talking about – I saw one estimate. In the last 2 years, about $7 billion, billion with a B, And under the Anti-Deficiency Act, if the government spends money they can't, there's fines and there's clawback too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the insurance companies, I mean, their shareholders should be cognizant of the fact that, well, you may be taking $7 billion in legal payments that may come off your books in a couple of years. I mean, that's
Congress,
serious.
The Republicans control both houses of Congress, and the Comptroller General is, and the General Accounting Officer is a creature of the Congress. So it doesn't have to wait for a judicial opinion to issue opinions on whether funds have been misspent or not. That's what they're there for. And I'm curious as to why no one is pressuring them to review this and issue their own opinion rather than stand by and wait for a court pronouncement. They've never been bashful before.
I will inquire, sir. I don't know the answer, but I will inquire. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
We got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you'd like to join the conversation.
Hey, Josh, it's Paul Salamanca. Thank you. I didn't log on until a few minutes ago, so I didn't hear some of the things that you said at the beginning, so please forgive me if my question is repetitive. I have seen that the court has taken what might be described as a purposive approach to interpreting the Affordable Care Act in the sense that it will do most anything to save it. And I think King versus Burwell is maybe Exhibit A of that, but we also saw plenty of that in the NFIB versus Sebelius case 4 years ago as well. With that in mind, and with the D.C. Circuit being constituted the way it is and the Supreme Court being of uncertain constitution in the next few years,
I like that, uncertain constitution. That's actually a very good description.
It seems to me, and I suppose I'm asking you to use your crystal ball here, but it seems to me that this is likely to be reversed. And I read Judge Collier's opinion, and I understand the 36B expressionis argument, and it's pretty darn good. But I've seen a lot of other pretty darn good arguments in this area go away because of the purposivist approach to saving the statute at all costs. I won't hold you to it, Josh, but just thinking out loud, what do you think of what I'm saying?
You know, it seems that Chief Justice Roberts breaks my heart every year. He broke my heart on Monday with the Zubik. I mean, he broke my heart last year with King v. Burwell. He broke with NFIB. It seems just about every year. So if the government argues this case the way they probably will, they'll tell the Chief Justice, if you rule this way, it will destroy Obamacare, and don't destroy Obamacare.
Okay.
I'm reminded of Justice Scalia's dissent to King v. Burwell. Indeed, this was his last dissent delivered from the bench, where he called the law actually not Obamacare, but SCOTUS care. And the Chief Justice made clear that the purpose of the ACA was to improve health insurance, not to destroy it, and he will read the statute in that way. I will note, though, that Judge Collier had a fairly, I thought, thoughtful discussion of why this case is not controlled by King v. Burwell, because nothing in her interpretation of the statute yields the result that Obamacare implodes. The reason why Obamacare implodes is because Congress chose not to fund it. It was actually a decision of Congress and not of the court's interpretation. And the reason why I think that's important is because Congress can fully fund this and this case goes away. Now, the government argues, well, maybe Congress intended all along to make it a permanent appropriation because they would not have let this go year to year. But that's such a difficult argument to reconcile with the text. So I don't know. I have no crystal ball. I know my heart's broken every year. It'll probably be broken again soon. And then I have to write a third book, maybe called Undone. But we'll see what happens then.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Of course.
The previous caller actually asked one of the other questions I was going to ask, and he pointed out the Anti-Deficiency Act, which occurred to me as well. We don't have, I don't think, very many Anti-Deficiency Act prosecutions, mostly because I think it's used as an interim statute, and people who spend money usually steer clear. This may not be your area, and it certainly isn't mine, but do you think there might be a rule of lenity defense on an Anti-Deficiency Act prosecution on the theory that we got opinion of counsel telling us that this was funded?
To circle back to the previous question, in order for the anti-deficiency judgment Anti-Deficiency Act case be resolved, we first have to have a judgment, is this payment illegal, right? That's the underlying question in the anti-deficiency claim. So assuming the court rules that these payments are illegal, then I suppose you could bring deficiency acts. I would love to see the memo put forward from counsel in the Obama White House of why this is legal. I would love to see that memo. Of course, that'll be White House privilege. They'll never release it. I suspect some people will fall on their swords, but you know, I'm not expecting those to release any sort of bombshells.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Our lines are once again wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we wait, Professor, to see if anybody else rings in. You mentioned it'd be a full 2 years before this gets to the Supreme Court, but you also mentioned, I think, the next step on the highway here is the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for this case. Has there been a notice of appeal, or what's happening next and when?
I may be wrong, but I don't think the government's filed a notice of appeal yet. They're going to stretch this out as long as the human leap can be stretched out. They're not in a hurry to get this case up. The longer this takes, the harder it is to reverse. And the fact that Judge Collier granted the stay was the biggest victory the government could have hoped for, because this issue could drag on for some time. Even if a panel of the D.C. Circuit finds that their standing is illegal, it can go en banc. And I think we saw last week in a really surprising order, the Clean Power Plan case basically went sua sponte en banc. It was supposed to be argued before a three-judge panel, I think, in June. And then the court as a whole released an order saying, hey, let's hear this all together at once, all of us. And I don't think that had happened to D.C. Circuit since the Microsoft litigation 15 years ago, when there were only seven judges left in the en banc court. So, I mean, this is a, speculation, who knows, but this was a surprising order. So this could drag on for a while.
I wonder if you, again, if you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. You mentioned your book. It's available on Amazon and at bookstores. Can you give us a quick outline of what you cover in your book?
Oh, Dean knows to ask the right questions. So my first book came out in 2013. That was called Unprecedented, the Constitutional Challenge to Obamacare, and discussed the NFIB v. Sebelius case. My second book is not out yet. It'll be published by Cambridge University Press in September, and it's called Unraveled: Obamacare, Executive Power, and Religious Liberty. And it discusses three main Supreme Court cases, the Hobby Lobby decision, King v. Burwell, and Little Sisters of the Poor. And it tells the story of these cases in Obamacare's second act. That is from 2013 through 2016. It discusses everything in between involving the government website, the shutdown of the government, the election. And I've added a chapter on Justice Scalia's vacancy. It also focuses on the House of Representatives lawsuit, as well as the various illegal manners in which this law has been delayed, postponed, and modified, what I call government by blog post. It'll come out in the September. I'll be happy to come back and talk about it then. Not for sale quite yet, unfortunately, but I'm still writing it and finishing it as we speak.
Well, we'd love to have you back, certainly before then, probably, but on some other matter. But certainly we'd enjoy having you back to discuss your book in greater detail, Work in Progress. And again, the title, Unraveled. What's the subtitle?
Unraveled: Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power.
Due out in September. Looks like we do have another question. Before we go there, let me talk about looking to the future again. Schedule of calls next week. So far, we have scheduled three teleform conference calls. Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern time, we'll talk about fracking and a couple of recent decisions in Colorado on fracking. Wednesday, we'll be talking about ICANN, which is the entity that oversees domain names, and whether or not that function should be exported from U.S. control to a more international controlled forum. That's Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we'll be talking about the Apple versus FBI matter. That's the encryption and the phone hacking matter. Today, of course, we're talking to Josh Blackman on the House of Representatives versus Burwell case. One question pending. If you'd like to be the next question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Yeah, hi, this is Jim Bowen. Question is relates to the risk corridor payments. How does this decision relate, if at all, to the risk corridor payments that were previously authorized?
Okay, thank you. So the caller asked about the risk corridors, and these are what are often referred to as the bailouts of the insurance companies. simply stated, the law says that if some insurance companies gain money and some insurance lose money, they'll spread the wealth. They'll basically take some of the gains and redistribute it to some of the losers. The House's lawsuit doesn't attach to the risk corridors. But there's another matter regarding the risk corridors that may very well lead to litigation. Professor Seth Chandler at the University of Houston has written about this to summarize a very complicated area. The ACA says that certain amounts of taxes imposed on insurance companies have to be deposited in the general treasury, and whatever's left over is sent to insurance companies that don't do very well. Professor Chandler has actually researched this in painstaking detail, and it seems that the government is not putting money into the treasury that ought to be put there, and is instead being put to other insurance companies who've suffered under Obamacare. So I think we have another instance where not only is the government spending money illegally, they're not depositing money in the U.S. Treasury as they ought to. This law is a cesspool of problems, and we don't even know the half of it. We've only discovered this because of very careful study of publicly available information. Or perhaps one day when I write my eighth book on Obamacare, we'll have access to the White House papers on this and figure out what was actually going around. This is something that should really shake the conscience and faith that people believe in the rule of law. And every time I think about this, I often get very, very upset as I learn more about it.
Let me make a final call for questions. We do have one more question pending. So this is not yet the final call for questions. Push star and then the pound button on your phone. Let's take another call. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone on mute. If your phone is on mute, you need to take your phone off of mute.
Indeed, I do. Thank you. Sure. So my question has to do with just instead of the specifics here, but just the general issue of very complex pieces of legislation, mind-numbingly complex, a web of complexity. And the gist of it is there a comparable argument that almost any complex piece of legislation, if you turn the power of the microscope up high enough, you'll find defects, technical defects, any of which could be used to challenge it. And is that by itself an equitable argument to say that we should just take a pass on those? Or do we actually risk putting any piece of legislation, whenever the political winds change, up for contentious dispute, because we have magnified these defects to the point where they risk the entire body of the legislation?
Thank you very much. It's actually a very profound question and one that was addressed by the chief in King P. Burwell. The ACA was not drafted under the most conventional circumstances. Nancy Pelosi famously said, you have to pass law to find out what's in it. Due to the nature in which this law passed, what we have now is the ACA was never meant to be the final version of the bill. You may recall that in 2010, Scott Brown won a special election in Massachusetts, becoming the 40th Republican senator. Up until that point, the Democrats had basically a filibuster-proof majority. The bill that we have was passed almost like a draft. It was meant to simply have the Senate pass something, sent to the House, there'll be a conference, and then they'd iron out any of the sorts of kinks that we have here. For example, the 36B, the King v. Burwell issue, that would have almost certainly been fixed at a conference. But because of Scott Brown's election, we didn't have a conference. And this law is basically passed without any thorough vetting of the final version. This is a very problematic way of passing legislation that changes 15% of the U.S. economy. Now, your question, though, is a good one. Can we even pass major legislation in this sort of gridlock environment where half the country hates the law and the other half doesn't, and the only way to do something is with a supermajority? And following that, should courts simply not magnify it, to use your phrase, to look at this less closely because we can't expect perfection from Congress? Call me a traditionalist, a Federalist perhaps. The separation of powers are damn important, and if Congress can't abide by them, then they're doing something wrong. This is not some sort of fluffy thing we can simply waive because Congress doesn't have enough votes to pass health care reform. Health care reform is great, bad, I don't care. The policy is actually not very important to me. But the separation of powers matter a lot to me, and to the extent that the courts are concerned with protecting them, I think the magnification argument becomes even a reason why we should have more scrutiny. I don't know, maybe if courts start scrutinizing legislation closer, the Congress will act more carefully. Imagine that. People respond to incentives. But as it stands now, the ACA is a law that was not fully vetted, to use the phrase of the day, before it passed. And we're dealing with a lot of the follow-up litigation because of these inaccuracies. I'll note briefly, I don't think this is a case where even the Obama administration thought there was a problem. They requested an annual appropriation for this in 2014. They behaved as if everything was normal. Only when Congress said no did this entire rigmarole come around. Thank you for the question, though.
We do have another question, so let's take another call now.
Hi, Josh. This is Lee Otis. My apologies. I also joined late because I was at Randy's book talk about our Republican Constitution. But to what extent had the House was the – and you may have just – therefore, you may have addressed this. But to what extent was the House very clear that they were not providing funding for this? And was the administration and everyone else on notice that they had a problem that they had not gotten the funding? I mean, I confess I hadn't been paying as much attention to this case as to some of the previous ones, but in retrospect I'm kind of surprised because it actually seems pretty clear cut in once you get over the standing problem. But I was wondering kind of to what extent was Congress and especially the House kind of acting pretty deliberately in not providing the funding?
So I can answer your question this way. I did a number of interviews for the book, and it's going to be in chapter 23 of the book for anyone interested. There was a request in the FY 2014 budget from both HHS and from OMB. The same request, but both of their budgets referenced it. And from what I understand, the House made it pretty clear that that line item was being denied. A subsequent budget sent to the House Ways and Means Committee omitted it. And from one of the interviews, I learned that someone in the House Ways and Means Committee, and this is their job, they very carefully compare one budget to the next. This is part of their mission in life. This is what they do. And they said, wait a minute, there's something missing. OMB is usually very precise, and they take direction. In fact, Sylvia Burwell, who is the head of HHS, used to be the secretary of OMB. So she knows appropriation law better than probably anyone else.
It's inconceivable. It's inconceivable.
So, right. So I mean, it's effectively the case, and I don't know what happened, but they requested the money, Congress said no, and then someone came up with this cockamamie explanation of, oh, they actually had a permanent appropriation all along.
Congress said no informally, or?
I think in the budget they passed, I can email you about this later, but I'm pretty sure in the budget they passed.
No one proposed an amendment, let's include this.
I'm not 100% sure of amendments, but I think Congress, the budget that came out, simply omitted it, and it was not there. But I mean, that's often how Congress does its funding. There was no special amendment.
But you said there was a subsequent budget that...
The following fiscal year. Anyway, so I'll check on that later. I'm pretty sure I'm right, but if I find otherwise, I'll email you about it.
Okay.
Let me now, or maybe once again, make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Professor, I think we've had our final question. We've still got some time left. Let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts or predictions or anything else you might want to cover before we adjourn the call here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dina. Thank you for everyone for the very good questions. I think as we study the ACA, we sort of moved into the second act, the Affordable Care Act. The first act was, is this thing constitutional? Is this thing funded? Is this thing violating religious liberty? These are the first sorts of cases. The second wave of cases, which we'll be discussing, focus on executive power. Was this thing implemented in a legal way? And with respect to a lot of the instances, they frankly weren't. The administrative fix, the delay of the employer mandate, the funding for the House benefits, the House staffer benefits. There was another instance where they basically, to summarize, the law said that certain provisions do not apply in the territories like Guam and American Samoa, and they basically relaxed this provision because it's going to destroy their healthcare markets. This was not a polished law that was worthy of the amount of change it affected, and there'll be significant challenges to it going forward. The only defense the government has in every instance is standing, because the decisions the government makes is to help people, not to hurt them. And when no one's injured, no one traditionally has standing. So I think we need to carefully analyze this, and in future discussions of separation of powers, keep in mind of how standing doctrine has been used.
Well, Professor Josh Blackman, professor and author, thank you so much for joining us. It's a complex set of issues. It will be interesting to see what happens on the standing question going forward, and then, of course, on the merits. So thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to your book, Unraveled, coming out in September. To the audience, thank you for joining as well, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about some litigation updates in the world of fracking. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.